Sea Grant and Lake Michigan. Waters in Transition. A production of the University of Wisconsin, Sea Grant Institute. Episode 9. Reefs and Quarries, Streams and Fish. Welcome back. For my last stop in my visit here at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee's School of Freshwater Sciences, I wanted to speak with someone who works directly with Lake Michigan fish populations. I was seeking a different perspective on all this information that I'd learned in the previous two podcasts about food webs, and maybe get a sense of what underscores these ongoing environmental problems that seem to continually beset the Great Lakes. I had heard of a professor at the School of Freshwater Sciences who not only knew fish, but also seemed to possess a deeper philosophical understanding about why people relate to water in the way they do.
And here it is, room 117, John Jansen. PhD.
Tell me about some of the Sea Grant projects that you've done involving Lake Michigan.
The Sea Grant projects are basically in three different areas. One has to do largely with what happens to the yellow perch, which is a nearshore fish. It's something that if the perch populations are healthy, the kids can get off the pier. Then there's work on larval fishes and actually how they interact with water masses. So the lake is not homogeneous. There are green patches full of food, and there are not so green patches. And whether a larval fish makes it or not depends upon whether it happens to land into a green patch. And that can affect the baby perch because they're tiny and have to be in a good green patch probably to survive. Then the third area is lake trout reproduction. And lake trout are the native top predator. They got extirpated almost 60 years ago. The general blame is laid on overfishing, followed by the invasion of the parasitic sea lamprey. The agencies have been trying to get them reintroduced since the mid-1960s when they got sea lamprey under control. But there's been virtually no natural reproduction until really in the last decade, when we first found out that lake trout were successfully depositing eggs on offshore deep reefs. Offshore means 20 to 40, meaning mid-lake reefs that come up to depths of 130 feet to 200 feet or so. That's where they're spawning.
So I can hear somebody out there going, wait a minute, reefs? I thought reefs, those existed in the Pacific Ocean. What are reefs doing in the middle of Lake Michigan?
You're referring to coral reefs, reefs that are built by animals. But reefs are basically any rocky structure that gives some amount of shallowness off the bottom. We'd call it bottom relief. But actually, we have coral reefs in the Great Lakes. It's just that the corals have been dead for almost 400 million years.
Get out. Where are these?
Well, I scuba dive on coral reefs in Lake Michigan. And again, the corals have been dead for almost 400 million years. But if you want to actually see the corals, all you have to do is walk along the rocky benches along the east side of the Door Peninsula, and you'll see lots of corals there, and you'll see fossil sponges. If you're very observant, you'll see fossil ancient squid-like animals. So, yes, we dive on coral reefs here, and I'm all for total restoration of the Great Lakes and bringing back those coral reefs.
Now, the corals we're talking about, didn't those die out in the Ordovician period or the Silurian extinction many millions of years ago? They're not even really the same corals that we have today.
You're right. They're different corals than we have today. And the die-off, well, actually, that's funny because the Ordovician is along the western side of the Door Peninsula. Nice fossils at some places there, but most of the Door Peninsula is Silurian, what we call Niagaran Formation, named after Niagara Falls. So the same sort of rock there, very tough. You can see coral reefs pretty easily on land around the Great Lakes, and probably the easiest one to see is the Thornton Quarry, the bypass around Chicago. 294 cuts across the Thornton Quarry. Just before you get into Indiana, there's a big hole in the ground. there. So if you've been on the bypass going to Indiana, you've been over a coral reef. And if you look to the sides, you'll see the layers of rocks. If you stop and don't get arrested, you can find corals there. But most of the Thornton Quarry has been excavated out. It's a big hole right now with the corals and other fossils removed. Well, that's one of the coral reefs. That one's on land, but there are hundreds of them underwater.
It sounds like I'm going to have to go up to Door County and investigate this dividing line between the Ordovician and the Silurian that you described. Well, cowabunga. That not only explains why there was a quarry at Harrington Beach, but since you might also recall surfer Longboard Larry talking about the Niagara formations in the fourth episode, that also explains why there are great waves on Lake Michigan. I had actually been to some of these rocky outcroppings John was talking about when the dog and I went to Whitefish Dunes. While the doggy napped, I had snuck off to record Lake Michigan pounding into those cliffs of fossil coral at Cave Point State Park. If you listen closely to the recording, you can hear a hollow booming as the sound of the waves is reflected in and out of the rocky caves on the shore. So how did Sea Grant help you with these things? Did they help fund the studies? Did they give you a boat?
Sea Grant funds the studies. And actually, for the lake trout work, they provided some of the initial funding for doing that. But that is very ship time intensive. We would probably blow out a Sea Grant budget to do what we did subsequently. But that funding got us started, and then we got funding from agencies that were more specifically interested in what was going on with lake trout. So some of the first funding from Sea Grant, and then basically a decade of solid funding after that from other groups.
Is that what they call a proof of concept? Seed money to get it going, and then you show it's worthwhile?
Yeah, it wasn't proposed as proof of concept. It was certainly one of the higher risk proposals, but we first found that there were eggs being laid out there. Very shortly after that, this was actually after Sea Grant funding, we found the first larval stages, fry stages of the lake trout. Once we found particularly fry out there and showed that we could do it, which a lot of people called finding a needle in a haystack, that's when the more solid funding came. That's a good way to do science.
So Sea Grant took the leap of faith that allowed you to do this confirmation of what's really a signature species for Lake Michigan, lake trout, or it was at one time one of the mainstays of the commercial fishery.
At one time, there was a huge lake trout commercial fishery with fish being shipped across the Atlantic.
You've done a lot of work with food webs. What's something that people may not understand or appreciate about food webs, particularly in Lake Michigan?
I think people vary from knowing a lot about the food web and knowing virtually nothing. But somebody who's a very experienced angler is likely to know a lot because they open up the stomachs of the fish to see what's in there. And if they're real curious about it, they'll go try to get it identified, which is not necessarily easy. But even then, you can run into anglers that know virtually nothing. So one very interesting experience from many years ago was taking a bunch of freshman students to the beach. This was in Chicago, with microscopes and a plankton net, and we threw out the plankton net, and all these fishermen from the pier came running over to see what we had. And I had the students show them the little tiny zooplankton swimming around in there, things less than a millimeter, plus some big things. The fishermen were just astonished that that stuff was in the water. And I said to them, well, you have to know that little stuff is swimming around for the little baby fish to feed on. And a couple of them looked at me and said, I never thought of that. So I guess having grown up interested in aquatic stuff, there are assumptions I made about what people would know just because there are fish in the lake and they have an idea that the eggs are small and therefore the babies must be small. The trouble with the water is that you can't see into it. Scuba divers learn some things, otherwise they miss a lot. But for the general public, I think they probably know virtually nothing about what actually is in the water. And that turns out to be important. in multiple ways, because living in Milwaukee, I tell people that water, clean water, is brewed, because what cleans the water is the animals and the plants living in it.
Brewed as in coffee?
Brewed as in beer. So it's more of a Milwaukee type thing. Okay, you have bacteria and fungi that are living in the water, just like the bacteria and the fungi and yeast is a fungus that sit in a brewery vat. And when there's things to be eaten in the water, organic things, digestible things, whether it's mashed up wheat seeds like in beer or other things in the water, the microorganisms take them apart. There are animals that eat the microorganisms. They poop that stuff out. They get eaten themselves. And it's all a big brewery. And if you actually look underwater and you see how much life there is in clean water compared to water that isn't clean, and then you actually have somebody tell you what all those animals and plants are doing, you realize that clean water is a brewery.
I've never looked at it that way. How's the brew in Lake Michigan these days?
That's an interesting question, because it's actually something of a challenge. The water right now is much more transparent because of the invasion of zebra mussels and then quagga mussels than it was before that invasion. And what was lacking in Lake Michigan in any kind of numbers was some kind of clam. So the zebra mussels and quagga mussels are clams, basically, bivalves. There were some clams out in Lake Michigan, but they were really, really sparse. But the water transparency changed from, well, this is a scuba diver perspective, from thinking that a clear water day before zebra mussels, quagga mussels, was about 6 to 10 feet of water, to now seeing 50 feet of water. If there's been a storm, it'll get turbid, but sometimes 100 feet. Now, that's more typical of clean oceanic water. So here's your question. Are the zebra mussels good or bad? Have they cleaned the water so that it's better? And it's a matter of actually who the user group is. You might think, well, the cleaner water makes it better for a filtration plant, but actually they have to worry about the mussels living in their pipes, and then the mussels are pooping in the pipes, and then you get that fecal matter and stuff's coming out of that, and you can get a bad taste. And so it gets pretty complicated. A few years ago, I was at a meeting of anglers all upset about what had happened to the food web for Lake Michigan. And the person talking to them was a scuba diver looking at shipwrecks. And he was just going on and on how great wreck diving is now because the water is so clear. And before that, you couldn't see anything. And there are all the fishermen rather upset at the clear water because of how it had changed the food web.
Let's talk about the food web. It's affecting the fish. You've worked with lake trout and perch in particular, right?
Actually, lake trout and perch are good sort of opposites, because the lake trout is an offshore fish. It's a deep water fish. It's an open water fish. Its part of the food web starts with what we call phytoplankton, which are tiny plant cells suspended in the water column. Those are fed on by little crustaceans called zooplankton that subsequently feed small fish that the lake trout feed on. And another fish in that food web would be the Pacific salmons that were introduced in the mid-1960s. So those animals, particularly the salmon, are suffering right now because that phytoplankton in the water has been pirated by the zebra mussels and then the quagga mussels into the benthos, the bottom habitat. That's a place where the yellow perch interacts. They feed on crayfishes. They feed on, historically, a little tiny fish called a sculpin, just a couple inches long, but formerly very abundant. The sculpins disappeared in shallow water because of another invader called the round goby. The zebra mussels and quagga mussels suck out the phytoplankton, starving the open water community of its primary production. Not so good for the salmon and lake trout. That energy, that primary production, is now near shore, near the bottom. You would think that would be good for the yellow perch, and there's a lot more production going on in shallow water for multiple reasons, because of the zebra mussels and quagga mussels. But the problem for the yellow perch is that the yellow perch have to start their lives feeding offshore on the zooplankton that are being starved because of the zebra mussels and quagga mussels near shore, and we're running around in a big loop now.
Maybe that's why they call it a web. Everything is interconnected and gets tangled. You were telling me a story earlier about a weird comparison on how people perceive invasive species.
Well, this is a matter, again, of being blind to what goes on in the water. So I was driving down Lincoln Memorial Drive, which is along the lakefront in Milwaukee, and on the west side of the road, there were signs saying that there was going to be a big garlic mustard picking over the weekend. Garlic mustard is an invasive plant that's making a lot of the wildflowers disappear, or at least become a lot more scarce. And I stopped and took a picture of that, because on the other side of the road, on the lake side of the road, it was a big stinking mess of washed up algae with zebra mussels underneath it, and the zebra mussels make the stench. And I thought this was rather interesting, that here was this sign for what people obviously see, at least people that like wildflowers, but the whole zebra mussel problem with algae had been building up for more than a decade, but most people were pretty much oblivious to it. And there were no signs saying, go clean up the beach. Water makes bad things disappear, but all of a sudden it builds up to the point where it gets to be a serious problem. And that's been really the story over and over for the Great Lakes. It builds up, and then it gets really bad, and we try to fix it way too late. And it's because we don't see in the water, because we're not fish, we're not aquatic.
Does water clean up easily, or does that depend on where the water is?
I don't know how to make a comparison with Earth, because it depends upon what you do to it and how easily it is to clean up. Here's another interesting comparison. So I have to prepare a talk for some fishermen in a couple of weeks. In part of the talk, I'm going to compare what's been happening on some Michigan streams historically versus Wisconsin streams. What happened in Michigan well over a century ago was that it got lumbered off. And as a result, streams got terrible siltation in them because there weren't the plant roots to hold the soil together. And a fish called the Arctic grayling went extinct. Lots of things got damaged with that. But second growth happened. And now some of those streams, the ones that are now in national forest and protected, are now top trout streams in the Midwest, the very best, like the Pere Marquette River, the Little Manistee River, very clean rivers. And they actually repaired themselves rather quickly in a matter of decades. But the repair was because of repairs happening on the land, that trees started coming back. Those streams are clean now because it's now part of national forest, and it's managed as a forest that you can use the resources of it. You can lumber it now and then, but carefully. On the Wisconsin side, there's been relatively less protection. The national forest and state forest on the Michigan side is, I did the calculation, it's 16 times as much area as we have comparably on the Wisconsin side of the lake. Our streams aren't nearly so clean. They don't harbor trout to any extent. They tend to be warm. They tend to get a lot of siltation. They're just not as well protected. But interestingly, we know how to fix those streams, which is basically leave a bit of forest border on them, and that will capture the silt. And then you have cleaner water going into Lake Michigan. You've got water that's got trout in it, potentially, rather than the carp and suckers and things that people bemoan. So to a large extent, ecosystems will repair themselves, at least from physical damage. Chemical damage is something else.
So Wisconsin needs a new type of Johnny Appleseed to plant trees on the banks of all the rivers. So it's my understanding that Johnny Appleseed was really into hard apple cider. That's why he was so enthusiastic about apple trees. So he should fit right in Wisconsin. All right. Okay, well, that was a great set of interviews we got here. It's time to pick up the doggies from Jane and head off to Grant Park State Beach. Did you guys have a good walk?
Oh yeah, having fun looking at all the boats.
So I think I was gonna take her... to Grant Park State Beach. They have a doggy beach there, don't they?
Well, I don't know. I go there a lot. I haven't taken my dog.
Hmm.
Yeah, I'm sure. There's gotta be an area there.
I'm gonna find out. I got some great interviews, and I hope to see you soon.
Yeah, come back anytime.
All right, thanks. And I hope that you will join us too for the next podcast as we head for yet another spot on Lake Michigan. This is Chris Bocast and Dogus. Till next time. This recording was produced by Chris Bocast for the University of Wisconsin Sea Grant Institute. Thanks for listening.